Welcome to the Wolf Connection Podcast. I'm your host, John Kalfa. Let's talk about some wolves. Joining us for this episode, we have with us one of the avian field techs in Yellowstone National Park, Dylan Sanborn. Dylan, thanks for joining us. Where are you joining us from right now? Are you in the park currently? Where are you stationed?
So currently I'm actually in Colorado right now visiting some family, but usually when I am out in the park, I live in Gardner, Montana, and then I'm stationed out in Mammoth Hot Springs, which is where our office is, which is at the Yellowstone Center for Resources.
So you're in Gardner with everyone else. This is great. We should just...
Gardner is the best way of putting it, yes.
I think Steve and I are trying to plan a trip out there. So I think we'll just have a huge meetup at some point in the spring. And just start, you know, hanging out in Gardner with all you guys.
Yeah, of course. Well, myself, Jeremy, Rick, and Jim, we're all there. So feel free to stop by anytime.
Yeah, it's quite impressive how many talented people are up there in Gardner. It must be stiff competition.
Oh, yeah, definitely out there in Yellowstone, because considering a lot of old, especially the researchers, we all live in Gardner, especially because there's not a lot of options besides there, because your closest town even past that is Livingston. So you just kind of have this hodgepodge of different people who work for the park who are super qualified and who work for the wolf program, myself who works for the bird program, and then people who work for the bear program and so on. So you have a lot of people that are pretty well qualified in their field, and they all just kind of pretty much live there in Gardner, Montana.
I mean, it is the hotbed, which is great. I mean, it's so awesome that you're all in one place, I would imagine. It's really good because you can just share research and data with each other, and it's not as though you're stationed even in different parts of the park. You're just really in the same town and in the same entrance to the park.
Yeah, definitely. It's where we're pretty much all there, and it's kind of nice because sometimes we'll even like carpool to work or other things where we're just pretty much all stationed out there in Gardner, and it makes it really easy to kind of collaborate, especially even if we have things that kind of go between, especially stuff with wolf program or bird program or vice versa, where it's just really nice to kind of have everyone, this little community that's out there, and we can kind of pretty much just all work with each other out there. And then we're pretty much, we just go up to Mammoth Hot Springs and then we're all there at work. So it's really nice that we kind of have this small little community that's just in this tiny town that's in the middle of Montana.
That's awesome. I want to get some background on you, because you right now you're joining us from Colorado, which is where you grew up. So how did you get involved? Did you want to study raptors and birds of prey and things of that sort early on when you went to college in at Colorado State? Or how did you fall into that?
It's actually kind of interesting. So I guess I'll first start with like kind of my first like real exposure to like wildlife, or specifically more wildlife in Yellowstone. So I did a road trip out to Yellowstone in high school with one of my best friends. And when we were out there, we were able to kind of see wolves, bears, and all the other kind of touristy things that you see in the park. And that kind of inspired me to get a little more into like kind of caring about wildlife and other things like that. And even then, from a young age, I was really into the outdoors and hiking and just being around animals and all that. And then afterwards, I decided to go to Colorado State University, which is where I got my bachelor's in fish, wildlife, and conservation biology. But actually, when I originally went there, I first went for zoology, and I was actually starting to be a veterinarian, and kind of I took a few classes, decided that I just didn't like it, didn't like the aspect of kind of being like trapped in like an office of some sort or a surgical room or any of that. And then I took a class early on in college. It was a freshman class to wildlife ecology. And by happenstance, the advisor for the wildlife department actually taught that class. And the day after I took it, I went to her office. I was like, hey, I'm kind of really interested in this field. It seems really cool. Can you teach me a little bit more about it and kind of what it entails? And especially like after I graduate, what are kind of like the different jobs I could go into for it? So that day, I switched my major over to wildlife biology. And as I was in college, I kind of picked up a few different positions as far as with wildlife, where I started out with the Rocky Mountain Raptor Program, which is where I did rehabilitation and husbandry work for birds of prey, including hawks, eagles, owls, falcons, for about 2 years while I was in college. And then also I did an internship with the Student Conservation Association in Minnesota, where I was doing kind of a whole mix of work, where pretty much my boss out there, they made me do things from veg surveys to GIS work to banding pelicans, great blue herons, egrets, doing fish surveys, just a bunch of different things. And it was kind of a thing I was able to use to really kind of broaden my resume. And then come senior year, I was applying for positions, looking at things for as far as post kind of grad work and everything. And after I kind of found a few positions, I kind of got offered two different ones at the same time. One was actually working in Colorado for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a tech, kind of just general technician, just doing different jobs. And then the other one was actually an internship for the same program, the Student Conservation Association, that I did a year prior to that. And it was working for the avian research program in Yellowstone. I was like, huh, this is kind of interesting. Which kind of one should I pick? And I was kind of inspired by my trip to Yellowstone, just thinking how cool it was there and how, like, I kind of always thought it'd be like kind of interesting to work there. And just, I thought, like, I'm young, like, might as well just kind of take this opportunity and see if it might lead to a job in the park. So I took the internship and started working there for the Student Conservation Association as an avian intern, where I was pretty much working with a bunch of different birds in the park as far as monitoring raptors, songbirds, water birds, just a few different things. And then at the end of the summer, my boss, who actually a lot of people don't know, with Doug Smith, he heads the wolf program, but he actually also heads the bird program in the park, which is really cool. So there's this kind of easy transition that I'm able to kind of work between the two. And where at the end of that summer, I asked him, hey, like, I'm kind of looking for work past this. Like, what should I do? And he's like, well, I would love to hire you for next summer and maybe bring you on as a paid position as a contractor. So I was able to do that. But also we talked about winter wolf study. And I was able to hop onto that winter, where I was working with wolves as a volunteer for the wolf program, and pretty much where I was on cluster crew. So where we're hiking out to different kill sites for wolves and collecting samples from those. And then kind of after that, I had a little break between winter study, and where I actually went to Hawaii for a few months and worked there doing research on endangered bird species, which were the nene, which is the Hawaiian goose, and then the uu, which is the Hawaiian petrel. And then I went to my contracting position with Yellowstone right after that. And then a year later, I kind of, during this past year, I was working in Georgia as a crew lead for a wood duck fecundity and recruitment project. And then around that time when I was working for that project, Doug, he called me and was like, hey, there's a position with the bird program where you would be a hire through the National Park Service. So you'd be a park ranger and funded through NPS and also working for the bird program. And I was like, oh, wow, that's a really cool opportunity. And like, I should apply for it. So I applied for it via USA Jobs, which is where you go on to get to most federal positions with NPS or any other federal agency. I applied for it, and then a few weeks later, after a few interviews and a few things, I was able to get the position working for the park, which was the summer where I was working for the National Park Service and Yellowstone. So I've been able to work there for 3 summers as an avian technician, but now I'm pretty much a park ranger and working for the National Park Service, which is really cool.
Man, that's you and all over the place in a short period of time. What do you? I'm going to jump right in because I love this angle of it, because up here at Wolf Connection, we always talk about the relationships that wolves had typically with ravens. But I want to get your sense, since you're the expert and you've been studying these birds of prey for a long time, or longer than me. What do you see as the relationship when you talk with Doug and all these different individuals in the wolf program of the impact that you've seen, I guess, with wolves that have come back in the park, and how that's affected everything, I guess, from the ravens and the eagles and the hawks that are in the park now? What are some of the things that you've seen?
So the things that we've been able to see with, as far as the relationship between wolves and corvids. So corvids are part of the corvidae family, which includes ravens, eagles, magpies, and crows. And more specifically in the park, it's common ravens and black-billed magpies, which are part of that group. And then eagles, which we have 2 species in Yellowstone, which include the golden eagle and the bald eagle. So some of the relationships that we're able to see is where wolves are able to provide carrion. So pretty much these dead prey items for these essentially scavengers, where eagles and ravens and magpies, they scavenge on wolf kills, essentially. And they'll also scavenge on other kills from cougars and other species and so on. But where we're able to see that post-reintroduction from the wolves in Yellowstone, we've been able to see where this kind of availability for carrion on the landscape, which is provided by wolves, it could potentially help bolster populations for such as ravens, where even my supervisor, she did a research paper on this whole kind of relationship. Lauren Walker, she was able to kind of look at how wolves could kind of regularly provision carrion for ravens, and it could potentially increase breeding raven populations within the park, potentially. But anyways, it's also where there's kind of this symbiotic relationship with more specifically ravens and wolves, where it's almost classified as kleptoparasitism. So kleptoparasitism, for people who don't necessarily know what that term means, is in short food stealing, or it's where in this case it's where these ravens, they'll actually follow wolves around in the park as they move through the landscape, and then when they make a kill, usually they'll shortly be on that kill not much long after. And so these ravens, they're not really doing much of the work as far as making the kill itself or any of that, because they can't do that. But that's where they're able to kind of follow these wolves around, and then being able to have this kind of all you can eat buffet from these wolves, where they're able to pretty much steal a certain amount of biomass from these carcasses that are provided by wolves in the park.
Now, how much meat are we talking about? Are we talking about like a third of a kill, or just a small amount that's hardly noticeable, you know, to the pack?
So that's actually partially dependent on pack size. So there's been a few studies that have shown where the amount of that ravens are actually able to take from these carcasses could be dependent on how large a pack is. So they've been able to see that larger packs, usually where just because these packs are making kills more often because they need to sustain their numbers but the thing is they're also going for these carcasses much quicker than say a medium or small size pack. So then where they don't really get a whole lot of biomass from it overall. But otherwise, if you compare it to a small pack, it's kind of a different issue, where with small packs, when they are pretty much making these kills, they don't do it as often as larger packs in the park, and where they don't necessarily need as much because there's not as many individuals that have to feed on that carcass. But there's kind of the interesting thing to think about, though, is there's this Goldilocks zone for kind of wolf pack size, where medium wolf packs, they actually usually provide the most biomass for these scavenging ravens, just due to it kind of being a mix of there not being so many wolves to feed at once, but also where they're making kills more often as well, too. So it's kind of really, to answer your question, it's dependent on pack size, but usually it could be a few pounds at a time or so, and it depends how long those wolves stay on the carcass and how much they take. So it's kind of dependent on quite a few different factors.
Yeah, so now that we're on this topic, there was a few, I guess they're theories. I don't know how easy they would be to authenticate, but there were a few fascinating theories that I was reading about. I wanted to know if you've had any experience with them or just what your thoughts are on them. But I was reading that potentially ravens can act as like an alert system, and that the wolves are aware of this, that sort of... you know, all these flighty birds hanging around, if another predator were to come in, another source of competition, that this would serve as some kind of built-in alert system. A second theory that I was reading is about raven language, that there's good evidence to suggest that wolves are actually, I don't know about learning, but at least reacting and responding to raven language. Like they're seen clearly reacting to raven calls or alerts. The third thing that I wanted to touch on was this theory that wolves and ravens actually may engage in play.
Yeah, so kind of delving into those topics, at least as far as with ravens and how they kind of react around different predators, is ravens, they do have alarm calls that they will make, and sometimes they'll make those noises in relation to other predators being in the area, where they'll actually use that to indicate to other ravens that there's a potential of another animal that could potentially cause harm to them, in this case being maybe another predator such as a wolf or cougar or bear or what have you. So where I could see with wolves potentially being able to hone in on those kind of call notes and being able to see if that would be an indication for other wolf packs that are coming into that area or competition as far as with bears or anything else. But at the same time, it could be a whole lot of different things besides just ravens, where wolves, they could key in on scents, or even if they hear other packs howling within the area, other stuff that they could key on, in on. But even then, ravens could potentially be an indication for them if other predators are in the area, which is really fascinating. And then for your other question, other topic that you're mentioning as far as with how ravens could potentially kind of play with wolves or wolves or vice versa. It's where you will see in some instances where wolves, they'll chase after ravens and they'll kind of try to capture them. And actually in some cases they do. And this will actually happen with eagles as well, where in the park there have been actually 18 probable cases of wolves killing avian scavengers, where it's been about 9 ravens, 6 golden eagles, and 3 bald eagles. So it's where there is this other interaction that wolves do have that could be kind of a negative effect towards these scavengers, including ravens, which is really interesting as well, because for ravens overall, as far as them like taking carrion from these carcasses, it is very beneficial to them, but there is somewhat of this risk where wolves could potentially either kill them or hurt them, or in some instances just try to play with them or what have you.
Because we see that with our pack up here in Southern California. There's a lot of scrub jays, and I think there's some magpies around the area also. We've actually had to adjust some of our feeding for a couple of our wolves that don't necessarily come down and eat right away. And what we've been seeing is that we would place the bowls in, and they're so opportunistic that they're probably taking up to a quarter pound of meat right out of that. Is that something that's sort of a cascade effect that you've seen along with, you know, these smaller birds, you know, the jays and the magpies as well, that they're feeding off of the ravens and the eagles and going to these carrions as well once the meat's available?
Yeah, so once the meat's available, we're usually with these kills, the first scavenger that is going to be on it would be ravens. So after that, once those ravens find those areas, actually eagles and other scavengers such as magpies as well, they'll actually hone in on those calls and sometimes be able to locate those kills via that. And where there is kind of this effect from ravens, where since they kind of are this beacon for where this carcass would be, where they'll make all these calls and they make a huge ruckus and noise, that it brings in these other scavengers, in this case eagles and magpies, where they'll hone in on these carcasses as well, which is really interesting. So as far as like being able to make a direct correlation between seeing how eagles could maybe hone in on finding these carcasses in relation to ravens, there's still a lot of work as far as like what we can study from that. But otherwise, yeah, you could see somewhat of a relationship between how eagles react to finding these carcasses in relation to ravens already being on it prior, usually just because of them being most of the time the first scavengers that will be on those.
So are ravens the only bird that has this close of a relationship with wolves? I mean, are eagles following wolf packs?
Not so much. So with ravens, usually they are kind of more of the primary bird species that does follow these packs around, where Dan Staler, who works for the Cougar Project and then also does a lot of work for the Wolf Project, he actually did a research project on looking at how ravens will follow these wolf packs around, but also how there's a level of detectability for carcasses with these ravens as well too, where for instance, like on these carcasses, you can't see all these scavengers, but usually where it's these ravens that are the main indicator for kind of seeing where these wolf packs are traveling. And actually a really cool thing that we do personally in the field when we are trying to look for these wolves is we do use telemetry and also spotting scopes to try to find these animals. But if those don't always work, you're actually usually able to kind of look for ravens. And if you see those in the area, you could actually use that as a detection method for finding these packs or even carcasses if you see plenty of ravens in one area where they're scavenging per se.
So when you're, yeah, so what, so go through some of your duties also, because you, I feel like you have this unique relationship where you can go back and forth between the Wolf Project and your avian field technician when you're studying these birds. So go into some of the things that you are sort of tasked with either on a daily basis or even throughout a season and the data that you're collecting with both of these species.
Yeah, of course. So I'll start with the avian program. So with working with them, we kind of have a few different surveys that we mostly focus on, species that we work with. So we primarily work with mostly songbirds, raptors, and water birds. So for songbirds, we do a thing called point counts. So point counts, for people who don't necessarily know what those are, it's where you go to a point along a predetermined transect and you essentially try to look for birds either via visual ID, so where you're trying to listen for calls and songs and identify them that way, or even through just being able to see them as well. And then also for raptor surveys, for those where we're mostly focusing on four species, which include peregrine falcons, golden eagles, bald eagles, and osprey. And for those, we're mostly doing nest surveys and then also doing some productivity surveys as well. So, and then lastly, for water birds, we mostly focus on two species, which include the trumpeter swan and the common loon, which can both be found in Yellowstone National Park. So as far as daily duties goes, it includes mostly kind of working on those different surveys, and where it also includes a lot of hiking to get to a few of our sites. Like I think this past summer, after looking at how many miles we hiked, it was about 600 for a season from May to September. So quite a bit of movement through the park.
Love
essentially.
It.
Wow. So it's a lot of kind of hard work essentially to be able to track these birds down and being able to research them. And then as kind of more of transitioning into wolf work, the focus of that is mostly where I've been working on winter wolf studies. So that's a 30-day monitoring period where it's intensive monitoring, where for observation crew, it's where we're out there from sunup to sundown watching these wolves, looking for different behaviors, for prey use, and a few other different factors. And then also I kind of do transition into cluster crew as well a little bit. And that crew is where we're actually physically going out to predation sites where we are taking a few different samples. And that includes the Iowa incisor, the metatarsus, a bone marrow sample. And we collect those and then we bring them back to the office so they can be analyzed later on. And then lastly, going into kind of more of my duties, I guess, as a park ranger working for the National Park Service, it's where my position is not law enforcement or interp. It's more where I'm just hired for the Park Service, but I still wear like the whole like ranger garb and all that stuff and everything. And with that position, it's mostly still where like we do have somewhat of a level of authority in the park, where if we do see people who are like doing things that they're not supposed to be doing, like such as like trying to pet a bison or something crazy like that, like we kind of are able to like hopefully kind of divert that and hopefully make it where they won't do that. And potentially if it is something that we are worried about, we will call LE Ranger in to take care of that. But also where if there's other things as far as like medical emergencies or things like that in the park, if we are available in the area, we'll sometimes help out with that if we are qualified. As far as like myself, where I have my wilderness first responder certification, so I've gone out on a few things where we've had to help either like injured hikers or even lost hikers, other things like that, and so on. So it's kind of just a whole mix of different things between like these kind of, I guess, two, three positions I'm kind of working at, where I kind of transition between three.
Do you like that as a, because you feel like you have such a big amount of freedom because you can flow in between all these different positions. Do you find that to be, how do you find that as you're in the park? Is that what you envisioned, sort of this journey for yourself, that you could do multiple things at once and not be sort of locked down into one specific avenue?
I kind of, well, when I was first working in the park, so when I first kind of did my internship with SCA, like I kind of saw myself just mostly sticking with birds, and then kind of just having Doug as a resource and a mentor, that kind of really got me more kind of enveloped in the wolf community. And actually, even more ironically, when I was in college and when I realized I wanted to kind of go into more wildlife work, wolves were actually one of the first things I wanted to study, but I just didn't really see a lot of avenues as far as getting into it. So I kind of got into bird work more of, and then it's kind of come full circle where I've been able to work between multiple programs. And personally, I really like it because I'm kind of able to connect my two passions, which are large carnivores and birds, and kind of being able to switch back and forth between the two willingly and being able to kind of get the best of both worlds, where I'm working with pretty much this apex predator, but also all these different birds that work in the park, which is really fascinating. Just, I think, a really cool opportunity to be able to kind of hybridize between the two things.
Yeah, that's got to be great because it's such a synergetic, like you said, a symbiotic relationship between really these birds and this apex predator. When you were out doing your wolf watching work or looking at some of the kill sites, what were some of the, were you involved in looking at certain packs? Were there certain packs you were assigned to, or did you sort of run the gamut as you were looking and studying in those winter seasons?
So at least for this most recent winter study, like mostly what I've focused on as far as different packs, it would be the Junction Butte pack, which is a pack that is in the northern range of Yellowstone. They're mostly in the Lamar Valley, and that pack has, at least as of when I did winter study, they had about 34 wolves in that pack, which is insane. But also, whereas mostly me and one of the other techs, Maddie Jackson, who works for the Wolf Project as well, her and I actually did this kind of thing where we would switch between doing that type of work and where we're doing observations, but also doing cluster crews. So I've been able to kind of, again, like even hybridize more as far as within the Wolf program itself, as far as hopping between observation crew and cluster crew and kind of doing these two different jobs.
So when you're doing this work with, I want to touch back on ravens again. Were there any myths or legends or things that you, through your observation and your work, that you sort of had to look after where, you know, wolves and ravens are tied so closely together? We see it up here at our facility where there are ravens everywhere and they're very opportunistic. They're very intelligent, obviously. Is there anything you had to dispel to any of the public or anything that, you know, through your education that you found there was some truth to some of these myths and legends that wolves and ravens were tied together?
Yeah, as far as that goes, it's kind of interesting where wolves and ravens, they do have this kind of connectiveness where, at least from an ecological standpoint, where in Yellowstone you have it where these ravens are pretty much scavenging on these wolf carcasses. But even then, in a lot of folklore myths, there's this kind of also this more cultural relationship between the two where you could kind of see this relationship between wolves and ravens and how they interacted, more of kind of a stance that's more related to kind of cultural folklore versus something that's more of ecological. And I've been able to kind of see that there is this relationship about how like some of that stuff might be kind of true as far as like why people see this relationship, because in Yellowstone, it's where we could see pretty much where ravens and other corvids are highly associated with these wolf packs and following them around in order to scavenge on carcasses that they've acquired. So there is kind of this bridge between the two, and where there is some validity in kind of more of that like folklore side of things, but also there's probably a few myths out there that might be worth dispelling that I wouldn't be as familiar with.
Now, are ravens following other predators in the same fashion, like fox, coyote, or is it just that wolf packs are taking down much bigger game, so it's worth the effort?
It's more worth the effort for following wolf packs because, one, usually wolves are taking down kind of more substantial prey items compared to, say, like a coyote or a fox. Like a fox or a coyote is not going to take down an elk or a bison or anything of that matter. So where there's kind of this higher association with wolf packs because there is more a variable carry-on for them to feed on versus if they're able to do something with wolves versus foxes or coyotes. And even so, coyotes are more of a scavenger rather than more of a hunter. So that's, again, where you might have ravens and coyotes on the same carcass, but not so much more of the same relationship that they would have with wolves versus where they're actually actively following them around in order to pretty much acquire biomass from these carcasses that these wolves are acquiring.
Mm. Are you able to, in your studies, track a particular murder of crows or even individual ravens and such, where they stick with a certain pack in a certain area because they know that there's certain kills that'll be laying there, a certain carrion that's going to be readily available? Or do you notice that ravens sort of cherry pick and go around to different packs?
It could kind of be more of where they could potentially more of cherry pick, because the thing is with ravens, they're opportunistic, just like wolves, where if there's an opportunity that presents itself, they're going to scavenge. So if, say, one pack makes a kill and another one does, they're not necessarily going to be just loyal to one pack. They're really going to more of try to get whatever is available, essentially. And with ravens, it's just where they will pretty much try to be more opportunistic as far as what they're trying to find, as far as being able to acquire a carrion from these carcasses, where if there is a wolf pack that is making probably a substantial amount of kills, they might more readily follow that around, where there might be more flocks being able to track those wolves as they move through the park. But even then, on a carcass where you could have multiple flocks on just one carcass, where usually the amount of ravens on a single site can pretty much range anywhere between a few dozen to over 100. So where you have quite a few of these birds that are just on one carcass site. So that's where it's more of kind of valid that these this kind of wolf-raven relationship, where it's kind of ravens are more of just kind of being opportunistic in what they're trying to acquire rather than just being more of loyal just to one pack exactly. And even then, as far as tracking ravens in the park, there is a project that is going on where they are banding ravens and putting telemetry equipment on them to be able to track them as they move through the park and being able to see what their home ranges are and seeing what their territories are throughout the park as well. And then also where some of these ravens could potentially go onto these carcasses and acquire biomass from them. And potentially that's where we could use that as a data point to be able to see what ravens exactly are using what carcasses and following what packs.
So are you finding any of the same information? If Stephen asked this already, please, you know, tell me if so. Are you finding any of those data points with the larger, you know, the ospreys, the bald eagles, the golden eagles, that in the trophic cascade effect that these species of raptor are becoming more plentiful inside the park and inside these ranges where these packs are clearly well established now, that those species and those populations are starting to build themselves back up from over the past 25 years or so?
Yeah. So we're talking about more of like eagles and ravens, where these pretty much kill sites could potentially provide more carrion for them and hopefully boost their populations throughout the park. So where with like golden eagles, we could actually kind of see that there's this relationship where carrion does subsidize kind of an important part of like their diet, where they're able to acquire quite a bit of food from these carcasses. And where prior to the wolf reintroduction in 1995, the main source of carrion for ravens and other corvids and eagles was pretty much from winter kills. So kills that were, or pretty much deaths that were from the winter, where either elk or bison or other prey items, they died from either disease, injuries from harsh winters and so on. So where that was their main source of being able to acquire food, versus after 1995, that more became a secondary mode of being able to acquire carrion. And then with wolves, that kind of became more of the primary mode of them being able to acquire food from these carcasses. So there is kind of somewhat this relationship between how these scavengers and wolves relate to each other as far as these carcass sites and being able to potentially kind of in a way bolster these populations through time, where as these wolves provide more available food on the landscape, it can potentially add to the overall population health of those different species, including ravens, magpies, and eagles.
So when you're studying these, so what are some, just basic rundown, what are some of the things that you're looking for with these, with these, with these raptors and these avians? Are you, what sort of data points are you collecting when you do your work?
So it really depends what kind of program I'm working for. So if I'm working for the wolf program, mostly when it comes to avian scavengers, it's where we're mostly looking at like which individuals are using these carcasses and then recording the amount that are on it. And then we look at that at the time of the kill and what's kind of our high count for how many of those individuals are on a carcass. And then also when we do hike out to these sites, we try to see if any of those avian scavengers are still potentially there, where like if you see a magpie or a raven fly off the carcass, you record that. Versus with the bird program, we don't necessarily relate it as much to what we're doing with wolf work, where we still do our surveys and we don't really focus as much per se on like ravens or any of that, but we do focus a lot on eagles and stuff like that, where they still are kind of involved as far as with wolves and all of that. So as far as like kind of answering your question, there we do kind of a mix of as far as like what we're kind of trying to like figure out from doing these studies, where with like ravens, we're trying to look at what they're utilizing from these carcasses and all that. But usually it's more just for the wolf program when we do that, versus when I do bird work, we don't so much focus on that as much when I'm working out there in the summer.
I want to ask this question because we've had a real great mixture of guests on the podcast, you know, ranging in all different ages and things of that sort. Yourself, Jeremy Sundaraj, Kira Cassidy, do you feel or do you see as a tech out in Yellowstone that there's, I don't want to say a youth movement, but more that younger individuals like yourself are starting to become more involved in ecology, biology, conservation, preservation? Do you see that? Is there any sort of a groundswell or more individuals that you see going into these natural studies and wanting to protect these species, that particularly in Yellowstone, but they have this opportunity that they want to go into this field?
Yeah, I think there is kind of somewhat of an upswell as far as like the younger generation kind of moving into these positions, especially relating to biology, ecology, or outdoor research, where I think there's kind of more of this willingness to get into this field because there's more issues with like kind of a decline of like multiple species throughout the world as far as like with extinction events, or even like myself of working with endangered species, where like that, like in Hawaii, that kind of is where like stuff like that has kind of made me more impassioned about like trying to preserve these animals, especially for future generations. And where I think a lot of people, especially my age or younger, or anyone who's even in college, where they are really wanting to kind of make a difference in the wildlife field and hopefully trying to save different species from extinction, or trying to research species so we could discover more about them, especially even just relating to wolves or birds or anything that's outside of those realms, where pretty much I think the younger generation, where we're going to be the next people that are going to be in these more of management positions, or where we're going to have more of a say in like how we manage and work with wildlife. And I think especially how there's more of an availability of like taking courses or doing different types of work in wildlife, where there's a lot more that you can kind of do versus in previous years or decades, where there's a lot of different resources for getting into wildlife. And a lot of people are taking advantage of that, where even I remember like when I went to college, there's quite a few people that were within my degree field, which was wildlife biology. So it's kind of interesting seeing that there's so many people that are in this field and actually even sticking with it. And it's just really awesome to be able to see how this younger generation is really wanting to try to make a difference as far as in the realm of wildlife biology and management.
Yeah, it almost seems like you guys are a big family. Like you said, like we were talking about earlier when we first started, is that this group is growing up in Gardner, Montana. I mean, it's such a great mixture of seasoned individuals who have been doing this for decades. And now this new crop is hopefully going to, you know, yourself included, like I said, Jeremy, who we had on a few episodes ago, that you're starting to learn from the Rick McIntyres and the Doug Smiths, and you'll be the next, you know, really keepers of the gate for this beautiful park that is Yellowstone.
Yeah, exactly. And it's where just in Gardner, we do have this growing community of young individuals who are wanting to get more involved in wildlife biology. And you have people like Jeremy or Kira, or pretty much these people who are going to be the next set of, as you said, Doug Smiths, Rick McIntyres, and so on, where really like having this community there where we're able to all work with each other, but also being able to kind of move towards the same goals is just really, really awesome, for lack of better words. But we're all able to kind of work towards this same type of thing. And hopefully, like, by being able to do that, it's able to help conservation efforts in the park and elsewhere, where you just have these young individuals kind of setting up this community, being able to help with wildlife management and research, but also where there's other pockets throughout the U.S. where you do have these communities that are wanting to kind of do more as far as wildlife research, or you have these other people who are in the same field working towards the same common goal.
Absolutely. I want to touch on this because you're a Colorado kid through and through, and Steven is now going to be part-time in Colorado. He actually just has a place set up in Durango. So with this, I'm sure you saw the wolf proposition that was proposed just this past year in Colorado for the reintroduction of wolves. What is your initial thoughts on that moving forward as a Colorado kid?
I definitely find it an interesting topic. It's definitely partially controversial and multifaceted, where the reintroduction of wolves in Colorado definitely kind of plays a big part in my life personally, just because being a Coloradoan where I grew up there, and then kind of seeing that this top predator that was once extirpated from the state is potentially coming back via reintroduction. And it kind of makes me think of quite a few different things, where how these wolves are going to affect different people that are within the state itself. So when it comes to wolf reintroduction, you have quite a few different stakeholders in that whole issue, where you have people that are on one side that are more of, say, environmentalists, conservationists who really do support it, but also you have people that are more of on the other side of the issue, where they're either worried or don't really support the reintroduction of wolves. And it's more of because of either kind of just beliefs that they already have as far as like what wolves can do in the state, as far as like, especially with ranchers, where they could play a huge effect in potentially predating upon cattle, and that could be somewhat of a monetary loss for ranchers or cattle owners in the state of Colorado. But also another issue that does potentially come up is when you compare Colorado to Wyoming or even Yellowstone per se, it's definitely a more urbanized environment. So you have to think about how the reintroduction of wolves might be more of an issue, just because there's going to be more of human-wildlife conflict, and this could be partially impactful to both wolves and humans as well, where there's going to be more run-ins between people and wolves, and where there could actually even be a potential for habituation as well, where wolves might be more used to people, and that's something that we don't want, especially when relating it back into the park, which is something that we avoid out there. So, but on the other hand, they could also play a benefit to other things in the park, other things within Colorado, where, for instance, they could hopefully regulate elk populations within Colorado, where with Colorado, it actually has one of the largest populations of elk in the world, which is pretty much estimated to be anywhere between 280,000 to 290,000 elk in the state. So there's quite a big potential for this available resource that's going to be there for those wolves to be able to prey upon. But even then, it's really how well are they going to be able to regulate it, because Colorado is a huge area, and that is a pretty large population of elk, especially compared to what we have in Yellowstone. So it's definitely going to be kind of an interesting subject to more of kind of focus on as time progresses and as they actually do the reintroduction and wherever that might be within Colorado. But really the things that would be most important to keep in mind is how are we going to manage these wolves once they're reintroduced into Colorado? What's going to be the most effective way of managing them? And then also, is what we're doing more of science-based rather than being based in some other field as far as like either emotions or what other people are wanting instead of what's being best for the wolves themselves, but also for people who might be affected by the reintroduction of wolves within Colorado.
Do you think could you see yourself possibly being in Colorado and being involved in that project when that comes down the pike in a couple of years?
Potentially, like it's definitely another job avenue where if I do decide to kind of more of stick to wolves, like that would be a potential thing that I could start working with where I'd love to kind of see where the whole like thing with wolves in Colorado goes and seeing kind of what happens with that. I'd love to be involved in that. But as of for now, that's still a few years from right now. So hopefully, yeah, maybe I'll be involved in one facet or another, but only time will tell with that.
Right. Absolutely. Couple last questions for you. What do you see as the, from your perspective, because you've had this, like I said, this great symbiotic relationship with these two species. What is your optimal outlook for the future of really the avian community and the wolf species moving forward as a young biotech?
It definitely could be a really interesting relationship to kind of see the connectiveness between those two types of things as far as with wolves and birds as things kind of move further down the road. But we can maybe see where there might be a trophic cascade effect potentially, where in Yellowstone you could see that in some cases where, for instance, like a trophic cascade, for people who are not as familiar with that, it more refers to the far-reaching effect that many top predators have on their environment, which is mediated via their effects on large herbivores and other predators, causing a cascade or chain reaction of effects down through the trophic levels of an ecosystem. So as far as kind of bringing it back towards bird communities, that's where in specifically willow habitats, where we can kind of see that there is this potential relationship between how wolves, when they affect elk populations and either cause their decline or also cause them to move more for the park instead of being more sedentary because they're at risk of being predated upon, we could see that these willow communities essentially do better in some cases with less herbivory that's happening to them. And that in turn actually could be beneficial to avian communities within those willow and riparian areas, where we could see such species as like Wilson's warblers or willow flycatchers, where they might do much better in those ecosystems due to that kind of trophic cascade effect. But even then, it's not necessarily as cut and dry as that, because as you probably know, trophic cascades are pretty complicated, where it's kind of more of a web effect instead of it just being a direct relationship between one or two things.
Yeah, we spoke to Nathan Varley last episode, and it's such a large dynamic and, like you said, a massive web of things that affect each other, and it's so complex how everything works together, really from the sky all the way down to the ground, right?
Yeah, exactly. Where each of these things kind of are connected to each other, and really it's figuring out like which piece fits into which and which one affects the other. And in this case, like where we could see kind of there is this relationship between wolves and elk, and where that's a little bit easier to observe. But as far as like seeing how elk with them pretty much browsing less on these willow communities, if that's more of where that's really that I'm actually not browsing as much and these willow communities are doing better due to that, or if it's other variables as such as even just like climate change or beavers being in those areas where that does help those willow communities and thus avian communities as well. So it's really trying to figure out which kind of piece of the puzzle fits to the other one, figuring out which one's more of a causation for another kind of part in that whole like trophic cascade effect.
Absolutely. My last question for you, Dylan, it's the one we ask everybody, is when you hear the word wolf, what are some things that come to your mind?
So when I think about wolf, the word wolf or wolves, I kind of, just because of my background and a few other things, I kind of always think of this sense of connectiveness. And when I mean connectiveness, I mean it from kind of two different standpoints, one being more ecological and one being more of kind of anthropocentric, where the ecological side of things is where, as I talked about earlier, how wolves kind of have this relationship with different types of birds, more specifically ravens or other scavengers such as eagles, but even songbird communities, and kind of an indirect effect. But also, as far as more from the anthropocentric side of things, where they do have a connection to people, where wolves, when you kind of think about like wilderness or what's the true kind of last wild thing, the first thing that comes to mind is usually a wolf. And in this case, because of that, I think a lot of people are really invested in wolves because they think it's kind of this last true sense of real kind of wilderness or untouched wildlife, which in the sense of wolves, it's not really that cut and dry. But anyways, we're also like wolves, so many people are invested in it, in them and just their ecology and biology, that you have all these people that want to learn more about them, want to watch them, want to study them, and so on. Where in Yellowstone, for instance, you even see all these different people from different walks of life, different communities all throughout the U.S. or even elsewhere, where you kind of see that wolves, in one way or another, kind of bring them together in order where they're able to watch these animals and kind of all have this kind of connection with them in one way or another, where really people are able to kind of come together over just this one species and really enjoy it for what it is in Yellowstone National Park or even elsewhere. And I think that's just really cool, where this one species just brings such a high level of connectedness between people, but also as far as in an ecological sense, they also kind of have that sense of connectiveness as well. So I think that's just really fascinating, kind of looking at those two things. And that's kind of what I think about when I kind of hear the term wolf or what it means to me personally.
Well, lastly, I just want to say, man, this was such a cool approach in addition to this whole wolf conversation. So I'm super appreciative of your unique set of knowledge. But on a lighter note, I need to know the story behind that picture on your Instagram of you and a giant goose.
Oh, yeah. That is actually, I'll correct you on that. That's Trumpeter swan.
Okay.
So Trumpeter swans, they're native to Yellowstone and also the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And they're actually the largest species of native waterfowl in the U.S. So are these huge birds with a 6 to 8 foot wingspan. And the thing that we do with them in the park is we actually will release cygnets into a few of the areas of the park during the fall. And we do that to kind of bolster the populations of swans in Yellowstone, where we're hoping those cygnets will kind of, when they do migrate out in the fall, that they'll kind of come back. And then eventually, once they reach breeding age, that they'll be able to kind of bolster that population that's within Yellowstone and hopefully being able to nest within the park itself. So that's kind of the story behind the large swan / goose.
I thought it was a snow goose or something.
Snow goose, yeah. Snow goose is a little different, yeah. but both are really cool.
And yeah, I'm not a bird expert.
You mean or not? Yeah, I mean, that's... your Instagram handle is perfect for you, because I mean, if anyone wants to see any hiking bird, I mean, well, I want you to promote your handle, because I want people to take a look. You have some awesome photos on there, as Steven just said, of birds and you in some wild places where you're hiking up and down. So tell people where they can, I don't know if you have any studies published or, but definitely tell people where they can find you on Instagram and how they can follow you and check out some of the things that you're doing.
Yeah, of course. You can follow me on Instagram at hikingbird, as you mentioned. There's no space or period in between hiking and bird. Then also I do have Facebook, which is at Dylan Sanborn, DylanSanborn. And also as far as resources about birds or wolves in the park, you can check out the Yellowstone National Park page, and they do have yearly reports that are both put out by the Wolf Program and the Bird Program as well. And those are great resources for being able to learn more about both birds and wolves as well.
Awesome. Yeah, like Steven said, Dylan, this was great. I love this perspective. Awesome. I love that you were able to talk about the symbiotic relationship, and I always appreciate the information. Thank you so much for giving us your time. And yeah, man, this was great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having me. This has been awesome. I've really enjoyed it.
That's awesome, man. Thank you again. Howls to everybody out there, and we will speak to you next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.